In his new book, Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gilbert Gahl examines how, he says, college football has come to dominate some of our best, most prestigious universities, reframing campus values, distorting academic missions, and transforming athletic departments into astonishingly rich entertainment factories, even as many university presidents look the other way. Gahl argues these abuses are mere symbols of something much larger and problematic, the business model that schools have created using football to brand their schools, monetizing every aspect of the game. Gilbert Gahl twice won the Pulitzer Prize and has been shortlisted for the Pulitzer four other times. For more than 35 years, he worked as an investigative journalist for The Washington Post, The Philadelphia Inquirer, and many other newspapers. Again, the title of the book is Billion Dollar Ball, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Gilbert Gahl to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to the subject of wanting to look at universities and the impact that these big money sports programs have on them?
Well, I'm an old-time business and economics reporter, and I was interested in college sports, and I was particularly interested in the growth of college football over the last couple of decades, looking at the commercialization of college football, looking at the sources of money, and then looking at, after it grew and changed, the impact that it had on the schools in terms of costs. The presidents are complaining about out-of-control spending. I'm looking at football even affects which sports get played at different schools. I was curious about the arms race and facilities, stadiums, locker rooms, the impact on the culture, certainly the impact on academics, even the way schools try to use college football, for better or worse, as their major brands.
What got us to this point, which is another way of asking the question, when did this start to become a problem, or has it always been a problem in the way that it was set up?
Yeah. Well, I guess what I would say is there's two answers to that. Football has always been presented problems to universities from its inception. Most of the problems initially involved things like injuries to players, deaths to players. Then there were problems with boosters, under the table payments, ringers, that sort of thing. What's changed over time is the scale of college football. And what you see is that beginning about two decades ago, for a variety of reasons we can talk about, that scale just ramps up enormously. The amount of money flowing into college football changes dramatically and then begins to have a dramatic impact on the operations of the athletic departments and on the schools themselves. And it involves everything from why you see Nick Saban being paid $7.1 million as the head football coach at Alabama, to assistant coaches' salaries going from, you know, maybe $100,000 to $500,000, or in some cases even $1 million, to why stadiums are getting ever larger, to the size of the television contracts, to the seat donations, and so on and so forth.
Just to give you an idea, to give the listeners an idea of what we're talking about money-wise, In 2013, the highest-paid public employees in 27 states were college football coaches. The 10 biggest football programs took in $800 million, with profit margins far surpassing those of Fortune 500 companies. So, a lot of money, and as you said, this ramping up. So, which basically, I mean, not to cut to the chase, but it just seems as if greed took over and you say, oh, we can make a lot of money on this, so let's make a lot of money off this.
Well, the way the business model for athletics at these five so-called super conferences, the elite football programs, work is that it is a football-first business model. What I mean by that is that the schools monetize every aspect of football imaginable, everything from charging donors thousands of dollars for premium seats, maybe even $10,000 or $20,000 for a seat, depending upon the program and where and how long the waiting list is, to the licensing fees, to the money they get from corporate sponsors like Nike or Under Armour or somebody like that, to the actual ticket prices and the inflation of the ticket prices, to not last or least, the television fees that get passed through to the schools through the conferences. And those fees have just gone through the roof in the last two decades, and particularly in the last few years.
You point out in the book that, like, just for example, Texas alone last year, when you're talking about the football elite, Texas alone made $78 million in profit. So that right. money then goes back into the athletic department, not into the university.
Right.
So
right. So many of your listeners are going to think that, okay, it's all right if these schools are making all this money because it's getting plowed back into academics, into the educational side, and
right.
subsidizing that. But the reality is that very little of it does. Most of it stays inside the athletic departments. And it goes for everything from lavish facilities for the teams, for the athletes, particularly football, what we're talking about here, to why you see that jump in salaries over time. So really, no, it stays in the athletic department. And also, I'll argue their case. I mean, one of the things that this money gets used for is to subsidize the poor sports, the Olympic team sports that don't have any revenues of their own because they don't have fan bases as such. It's not a form of entertainment. It's a form of participation. And so football ends up subsidizing some of those teams.
And as you say, arguing their case. So if you're Nick Saban and they're giving you $7 million a year, I guess you could argue, okay, but if the program's bringing in $70, $80 million, yeah, I want my share of that.
Well, certainly Nick Saban and his agent are arguing that.
Right.
I mean, without a doubt. When Nick Saban was at Michigan State University in 1999, just before he jumped ship to LSU, he was making, I think it was $697,000 at Michigan State, which, you know, not a small amount of money, but he thought he was worth more, and he jumped to LSU, and I think his initial contract there was $1.2 million, if I remember. You know, and now at Alabama, it's up to, with all those national championships, it's up to like $7.1 million. So the real question is, what's Nick Saban really worth? How does his salary compare with the private sector? If Nick Saban were running a business worth $80 million in a private sector, would he get $7.1 million? I mean, based on all the data that I've seen, the answer is no. He wouldn't get anywhere near that. That his salary accounts for roughly, whatever that is, 8% of the total revenue stream for the football program. You don't see many CEOs in private companies of comparable size with salary packages or pay packages that are equivalent to that. You just don't see it. So that gets me to this question of, well, what's a football player really worth, or football coach really worth? How do you measure it? Who determines it? And the reality is that it's really determined by the coach and by the agent of the coach and by the athletic director. And athletic directors, in my opinion, overpay for these head coaches.
Let's look at the case. You chronicle this in the book. It was one of the things that really shocked me. Charlie Weiss was on the coaching staff of the New England Patriots, wanted a dream job, probably could have gone into the NFL, certainly had a lot of offers to be a head coach in the NFL, wanted his dream job at Notre Dame. Goes to Notre Dame, it doesn't go very well. Then he goes to another job, and now he's not even working. Talk a little bit about the money trail there.
Yeah, so again, this is one way of thinking about the so-called marketplace for head coaches is the buyout packages that they get. And, you know, I was aware of what they were, but I wanted to look at them more closely. So I looked at Charlie Weiss, not to pick on him. He's a good coach. He just was a pretty unlucky coach at college. He went to Notre Dame, and in the very first season, they got off to a real good start that year. They lost a very close game to USC, which was then ranked number one. And Notre Dame tears up his six-year contract after six games, a game he lost, even though it was a close one, and says, we want you, we like you so much, we're going to extend your contract to 10 years. So, you know, magical thinking, they give him an additional 4 years. He's guaranteed all this money if things go south, which eventually they did. I mean, the team begins and ends struggle, and eventually Notre Dame says, we got to let him go after some fairly embarrassing losses to lower-tier schools. But they owe him all this money. And you know, God bless him. He I don't blame him. That's just the way the model worked. He gets paid. You know, my calculation is roughly about Notre Dame owed him roughly about $17 million. Could be a little more, a little less. Couple of years later, he gets hired as the head coach at University of Kansas, which right. is a not very good football program. It's a basketball school. It's not a football school. They always struggle. They hired him because he's Charlie Weiss and he has a brand name and people know him, and they hoped that he would succeed and turn around the program, but he didn't. You know, the program had terrible record first 2 years. I think they won 4 or 5 games. And then in the third, started the third season, you know, they got off to a bad start and they fired him again. Kansas fired him. But he had a 5-year contract, so he was owed a couple of years, and I think it worked out to about $5.5 million or give or take. And so, you know, for 2 jobs, he's getting paid roughly, you know, $23 million not to coach. Again, I mean, hey, God bless him for getting the money. But the reality is, I mean, what I'm thinking about is, well, what does this say about this so-called marketplace for college coaches? And if you look at buyouts, I mean, there's just tens and tens of millions of dollars in buyouts yeah. that go to these coaches who fail. So in an odd way or a perverse way, it's kind of rewarding failure as much as it's rewarding success.
And speaking of that, rewarding of success versus failure, you point out that there are 120 schools in Division I football. Half belong to the 5 super conferences that control all of the money. The other right. half, you point out, lose millions and millions of dollars playing football, being a part of this program, which ultimately gets tagged on to the students who go to those schools.
Yeah, so, I mean, college football, one of the things that's occurred is it's divided. It's split. So you have these 65 schools in the super conferences, the 5 super conferences that benefit from these extraordinary money flows that come in, these revenue flows that come in, everything, especially television money, but also these seat donations and corporate money. Then you have all these other schools that want to play at the highest level, but truthfully, most of them don't have a chance of getting there, they're never going to get there, but yet they insist on playing at that level because they have this thinking that unless they have a major football program, they're not a real university, and people aren't going to take them seriously, which is pretty bizarre and pretty interesting to think about. But those schools, unlike the super conferences, because they don't have money, they end up taxing their students through these fees, some of which are transparent, some of which aren't, to fund their football program. Whereas the elite schools, you know, they're operating off of all this profit that they take in and the revenue streams that they have. So it's really a case of haves and have-nots, and you have schools like UMass up in your neighborhood and Florida Atlantic to an extent, Florida International and Akron and Eastern Michigan and New Mexico State where, you know, they just don't have the money. Fans don't go to the game. Some of them build big stadiums that they can't fill. They're half empty. They have to buy their own tickets in order to satisfy the NCAA requirements. Mm. And it's just a real long slog and a money-losing operation that, you know, economically at least makes no sense.
It's a fascinating story. The book is Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. Gilbert Gall, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Great pleasure. Thank you. The book is Billion Dollar Ball. It's published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.